invites his family members, he invites his companions to join him on this journey towards Kufa, knowing that in the end, this would end in his martyrdom.
Yes, okay. Sheikh, another question for today's episode is that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam lost the war to Yazid.
Right.
He and his companions were killed and his family were taken as a captive. But it's still the story of Ashura and Karbala is alive in the history. It's fresh. I mean, this story is still recited and referred to. So from one side, we have Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, who was overwhelmed by Yazid. From the other side, we have this freshness in the history of Islam. How is it possible? How do you answer this contradiction?
Right. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we have this concept that in Islam, martyrdom is the biggest honor that a person can get in life. So what is important here is that what was the goal of the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam? If the goal of the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam was only to get worldly power, to become the leader of or the ruler of the ummah, only the hakim of the ummah, then we can say that he was defeated. But the goal of the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, in his own words, was much, much bigger than getting the rulership or the leadership of the Muslim ummah. Rather, the goal of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, in his own words, was Islahi ummat jaddi.
Yes.
And to awaken the people to amr bil ma'ruf wa nahi az munkar, to tell them what
enjoining the good and forbidding the evil.
So it was an Islahi, a reformist movement. And this reform movement and this going back to your roots movement was all that was achieved and through the sacrifice that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam gave. So if we are clear about the goal of this movement, we know that Yazid and the people who supported Yazid, the Bani Umayyah, these were the losers and the winners overall, not only in the material world, but also in for the cause of this religion, was the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
That's right. So all in all, vividly, there is no contradiction between the two.
True.
I mean, for instance, we could say that that's right. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam lost the war, but he was successful.
Yeah, we can say that even the aim of the movement was to awaken the people, amr bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar, forbidding the right and forbidding the evil and enjoining the right.
Okay.
So this aim was even achieved by the death of the imam. The death was also a victory because even in his death, he was able to awaken the people. For example, the episode that we recorded about the head, severed head of the imam reciting the verses of the Quran that Am hasibtum anna ashab al-kahfi wal-raqim kanu min ayatina ajaba. So this same verse, while being recited by the severed head on top of a spear, is going to awaken people. The khutbas, the sermons of Lady Zainab salamullah alayha in Damascus and in Kufa are awakening the people. The Muslim ummah is awakening from its slumber. And that's why we see that after the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, all these movements are coming. For example, the movement of Mukhtar, Mukhtar-e-Saqafi comes about. The movement in Medina comes about.
Tawabin, yes.
The Tawabin.
Yes.
All these movements are basically for the cause of avenging the blood of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. So we can say that even in the material terms, this movement was successful. And also in ukhravi and revelational and spiritual terms, we can say that this movement was successful. And to this day, we can see the fruits of this movement in the Islamic revolution, in which Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, says that one of the fruits of the movement of Karbala is the revolution that has been led by Iran and the Islamic Republic of Iran.
That's all right. All right, Sheikh. Thank you very much. Anything missed, Sheikh? No, nothing. Thank you. It was very kind of you. Thank you very much for a nice elaboration regarding these two questions, two important questions related to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. It was very kind of you.
Thank you.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. لعلي وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في
Welcome to the Israel Watch. In this episode, we will focus on the deteriorating economic reality in the occupation entity due to the ongoing aggression on Gaza and the military confrontations on the supportive fronts in Lebanon, Yemen, and Iraq, in addition to the losses incurred by the Israeli economy as a result. To discuss these, I'd like to welcome Dr. Ali Hamiya, a military and strategic researcher. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
The losses resulting from the continued aggression have taken their toll on the occupation army, which suffers from a significant shortage of soldiers and military equipment, leading the army leadership to delay the enlistment of women in the army corps due to the shortage of tanks and vehicles, many of which were destroyed during the battles in Gaza. So, Doctor, how much of a challenge does this lack of military resource actually pose for Israel?
We can see that economy, from economic wise, we see there is some kind of collapse in a civil way, in a military way, and in all ways in Israel. We can see that most of what we are talking about, like most of main battle tanks and.
Yes.
Armored vehicles and the personal carriers, and also about shells and ammunition, they have lack and they have shortage in that because of the confined area war against Gaza. And we can see most of those are now cannot tolerate to have the new recruits and especially women. To have due to the lack in quantities and numbers of such vehicles to carry soldiers.
Well, as you mentioned there, Doctor, they do obviously have a lack of tanks and military equipment and soldiers. Can the U.S. here actually make up for these losses, knowing what they have, of course, nowadays on their plates?
Due to the disintegrated World War III, what's going on in the world, like we are talking about Europe, and we have also economic crisis, and we have also in the United States, we have all over the world, we are talking about what's going on, the war that's going, or the aggression going against Gaza by
yes.
Israel. And we can see that the disconnected Babel Mandeb, it's totally, almost totally closed, and in the Red Sea, we see that the United States is not free to do what they used to have managed to do by their fleets and navies. Now we are talking about, no, United States cannot tolerate to cover all the losses that is done by Israel, and especially military-wise, we have, because we have a big war going on in Ukraine against Russia, we have a big preparation from the 7th Fleet against China in the China Sea, and we have a preparation in the Mediterranean Sea. So all those preparations, United States also feeling the lack and shortage of equipments and ammunition. So no, United States cannot cover all the Israeli losses.
Well, with that, we are going to continue. The greatest economic challenge for the Israeli entity is the severe losses incurred by the occupation army due to the ongoing military battles with the resistance. This has led to the decision to extend the service period in the army, which will lead to further financial burdens. So, Doctor, basically, to what extent will this financial burdens increase as a result, as we know, from extending the service of the reserve soldiers who receive their salaries from their civilian jobs and, of course, left for the Army Command and the military, the Ministry of War?
To make the long story short, that the army, or this army, is exhausted from financial-wise and also from military-wise, and we are talking about equipments. And now we are talking about the doctrine. We are talking about the inside of this the army. We are talking about extending the duration of service for every soldier. And instead of reducing it by 2 months, as he said, it's extended to 4 months more. So it's mean like it's extended 6 months. Instead of 30 months, now they have to serve 36 months.
Exactly.
And instead of compensation for every soldier to get like some kind of bonus from 10,000 shekel, now it's 30,000 or 2,500. It means it's reduced by 60%. We are talking about collapsing inside the army. If I want to go to fight,
yes,
I have to have instead some kind of relaxation by more money, more salary, better lifestyle. But the problem is those soldiers in Israel used to work another job.
Yes.
And we are talking about 65,000 firms closed. And we are talking about Haifa port is slow, and Eilat port is shut down,
exactly.
Zero. Is paralyzed. Those two things. And we are talking about also that those army, those soldiers, they cannot have like some kind of going home for vacation now. And they have to fight. And they have to fight in confined area, as I said before, in Gaza. And they are losing.
Well, Doctor, I do want to go ahead and cut you off there 1 minute. You mentioned Eilat. To what extent is it actually being impacted during this economic crisis? You said it's closed down completely.
According to them, yesterday I heard that they say it's zero income and it's shut down. And this due to the strikes coming from Ansarullah. And also zero vessel coming to the port. This is like from one point. Another point, you can see that some kind of displacement of Gaza envelope. They are not returned yet. We are talking about economy, but this economy collapsing, it's due to, I'm talking about due to the war against Gaza. So we are taking military-wise. You asked me before, those countries are head of the capitalism in the world.
Yes.
If like such country as Lebanon, if we have some collapse in economy, we have some other kind of way to go through it. But those countries are living in a capitalism.
Exactly.
When you are talking about collapsing in economy and collapsing in the soldier who is protecting the economy as what's going on,
yes.
Now both along they are collapsing, the exactly. army and the economy.
Well, doctor, with that, I'm sure we are a bit short on time, so we do want to go ahead. 65,000 businesses have closed an occupation entity since the Al-Aqsa flood on October 7th last year, and this number is expected to increase if the war continues as it is now. Israeli social media has been flooded with comments describing the deteriorating economic situation in which the Zionists live after 9.5 months of war in Gaza and the north.
Army, no security and no economy, a cabinet of failure and negligence. Yael, Israel is in the greatest decline in its history, bereaved, captivated, injured physically and mentally, with a collapsed economy and a deep internal rift after 9 months of war. Shai, Israel is disintegrated. No external security, no internal security, no economy. A system that does not work. Kira, not 1,400 dead or 100,000 displaced, nor global boycott, nor the de facto occupation of the North, nor the economic collapse will change the cabinet.
Well, doctor, I do want to go ahead and make a comment here. As we know, 85% of Israelis' commerce relies on the sea. Isn't this correct?
I believe that the most important what's going on, not only what's going on the sea or the water path or strait or
yes.
whatever. We have to talk about, because I'm a military analyst, and
yes.
I would like to say that what's going on the battlefield and destroying all those kind of tanks and AVs and the personal carriers, and even like destroying the some kind of guns. We are talking about the contracts that usually Israel sell to the other countries, military equipments. Now those factories, those arsenals are totally out of order. We are talking about the north, which is the food basket for the Israelis. Now it's shut down. So it means not only the economy in Israel is collapsing, also the army, the factories, and all the even though we are talking about the Israelis economy and trade outside and inside is going down.
Well, as you're mentioning there, doctor, could this economic situation basically push Israel, the Israeli cabinet, to agree to a ceasefire?
It's two different subjects. Let me tell you, there is a let's say separation now. They cannot unify their opinion about between the officials, the military, and the intelligence. It's going on now for 10 months, and they could not come up with the only same opinion or same decision.
Yes.
To be taken. Either we cease fire, or we withdraw, or we continue, or we go for Hannibal protocol, or we exchange POWs. They don't know what to do.
Yes.
Even though they are lost in the second day strategy.
Well, with that, let's go ahead and move on. 75% of settlers displaced from the Gaza envelope areas and the occupied northern Palestine have suffered economically due to the security situation with Gaza and southern Lebanon, and their living standards have declined significantly. So, doctor, are we talking about a serious, unprecedented economic crisis for Israel, or would that be an exaggeration?
I think we can hear the Israelis now crying about what's going on. How
yes.
they've been like before 7th of October, and how they live right now. It's not only the economy is collapsing, also their personal life, their private life. They don't know what to do. Now they are displaced from one place to another. And even though I can hear they are whining like the government is not doing its job, they cannot heal the wound.
Yes. Well, let's go ahead and continue now. Due to the extension of the evacuation period for settlers from the south and north and the financial costs incurred for their housing, Netanyahu's administration was forced to reduce the budgets of many ministries, causing internal disputes in the cabinet. So, doctor, basically, do these cuts serve to broaden the rift between the Israeli public and, of course, their cabinet?
when a government start to have a budget cut, it means they are behind and they are going slowly, and they live in a shortage. And this is, as I heard now, it's affecting the even the social departments.
Yes.
When it goes down to the to such edge, it means this country is going to a unknown place.
Well, with that, I'd love to thank my guest, Dr. Ali Hamiya, a military and strategic researcher, for joining us. A pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Until next time, salam.
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and right now we are here with me, Amina, and with
Asma
at Youth Station.
Of course.
A cozy corner where we gather to talk about various subjects and various topics. I feel like in today's age, every youth goes through this path, through this phase,
mm-hmm.
where they're trying to find themselves.
Yeah.
And they ask themselves the questions. What was I born for? Who am I? What did Allah bring me here for?
The existential crisis.
Yeah, I feel every teenager goes through that phase. Every youth has
yeah.
that phase where they question themselves.
You know, it has been an eternal question. I mean, like, since Eden, people have been asking this question from themselves. And it's a natural compulsory part.
Of course.
And phase of our life that happens. But then, how do we answer to it differs from one person to another.
Yeah, definitely. Everyone has their own answer.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has their own answer, like, who am I? It can be a literal question, like, I'm Amina.
Of course, and I'm Asma.
I'm Amina. This is Asma with me. This is who we are. Or you can go deeper.
But what do you want?
Yeah, no, you can go deeper.
Come on, a stranger, what do you want?
Are we strangers now, Asma? Who are you? Who are we? Who am I?
Do you know who is Amina?
Who's that? Never heard of her. But to like let go of my identity right now, of who am I, I'm Amina, I was born in Australia, I have a child, blah, 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 yada, yada, yada.
Mm-hmm.
We can go deeper than that. Who am I? Truly, who am I?
Yeah.
As a human being put onto this earth.
Exactly.
What did Allah make me?
Mm-hmm.
Who did Allah make me? A servant?
And that's so very deep.
It's very deep, yeah. And this is what was going to be very deep. So to answer this in an Islamic way, Allah made us as his humble servants
mm-hmm.
to people on this earth, and he put it as a test for us.
Exactly.
To see whether our faith for him shall remain or not. And then we go to the next part, what do I want?
There's this verse that every time... we turn on the radio to listen to the praying time. Before that, there is a part in which the narrator keeps retelling this verse, which is so beautiful. And it says, it's actually a verse from the Holy Book of Quran that says, مَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنسَ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ. That is, I did not create a human being either than praying. I just created human beings for praying.
And the prayer has different terms, of course.
Of course, different
yeah.
terms. And the way I interpret it is love. Because, you know, when you pray, if you do it as a mechanical thing, it does not have any worth in
itself.
It's
empty.
It's so empty.
Yeah.
It does not have anything. The thing that adds worth to it and makes it so respectful and so worthy is your intention, plus the much of love you share with your Lord. That's the thing
that
would add to its significance.
I feel like our whole day builds into what we feel during the prayer.
Exactly.
You know, remembering Allah through the whole day, remembering Him, you know, saying like His name, He's there with me, and it's just showing our love. And then when we come to our prayer, we can enter this peace of mind and this feeling of absolute love towards our Creator.
So let us just clarify the setting for ourselves.
Yes.
Who am I? As a human being, when I ask myself, I come up with different answers.
Many answers.
Many, many. So we are missionaries that have got some missions to accomplish in this world. We have came onto this. We have came into this world with some missions to accomplish. What are those missions? Well, it differs from one person to another.
Yeah, I mean, don't forget that Allah has made every being in this world, every single, not any being, every single thing that He created with a purpose in mind.
Of course.
So if you're ever feeling useless, like, why was I put on this earth? Allah, why did you make me? Remember that our Lord, our Creator, did not make us without a reason.
See, I would put it this way, in a much literary way,
yes,
that sometimes, because many people degrade themselves to the point that, okay, I have done nothing in my life. You are just a simple gardener. You have to create some flowers. You are there to take care of some flowers. Because those flowers have to be taken into a person who would create some sort of perfume out of those flowers. And then that perfume gets into the hand of a writer. And then that writer gets inspired. And then
he or she
would write something, a piece that is so fantastic in a way that would change the world.
Yeah, and someone who reads that piece feels very inspired by it.
You think you have had no hand in that writing?
We don't know.
You of course had, because you were the first one who created those flowers, and those flowers came as a perfume, and that perfume came to that writer, and that writer created such a beautiful piece because he was inspired by that perfume. See? Sometimes small, simple, little detail that might not be so important to you.
We might not even see it.
Create the entire change.
Yeah, we don't know it. See, we don't know Allah's plans for us.
Exactly.
We just have to assume. We just have to assume that I was made for something, and Allah knows that. And I'm sure that I have a purpose in this life.
Exactly. And do not degrade yourself.
Don't. Yeah.
And the position you have in this
world.
Because
if you're degrading yourself, and not, you know, astaghfirullah, you're degrading Allah.
Yeah.
You're saying that if you're saying you're useless, yet made for no reason, then did Allah make you for no reason? Is that how you're going to think?
I've thought a lot about this. Who am I? And the gist of what I thought about was simply like this, that even if you do nothing, I mean, not that you don't want to, you have tried, but then you have nothing tangible for people to call as accomplishment. Maybe your existence as a daughter to your father, as a daughter to your mother, as a sister to your brother,
a mother,
as a friend to your friends and classmates, as many other adjectives that you could get in
as
this
a wife,
life.
Spouse.
Yeah, of course. Just this existence of yours could change the entire life of other people around you. And this is enough that you take care of your dear ones and you try to be a good obedient of Allah. I guess these are enough. What else God wants us? Doesn't He just ask us to be a real human being who cares about others, who cares about the responsibilities that God has put on their shoulder? No, I don't think so. The only thing He wants from us, just as I mentioned in the Holy Book of Quran, He says it very much directly, that I created human being to pray, to worship. And by worship and praying, He does not mean the act of repeating something and parroting things. No,
He's literally meaning it.
He actually and literally means, I created you for nothing except love. The thing he wants us to have is a mutual love. And that's the core of our existence.
It is, because we have to remember that Allah loves us so much.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to give that back.
Exactly.
So I hope that the youth that are listening to this, especially youth, okay, there is more for you to come. The stage that you're in your life right now, there's way more for you to come.
Exactly.
It's not going to stop there. It's not going to end there.
Sometimes your mission in this life is just to say a sentence to someone to change their life.
We don't know.
To save them from absolute death.
We have to keep on living.
Yeah.
We have to keep on worship, loving Allah with all our being. And we will, some people actually say, that just came to my mind, but so if we don't know the purpose that we were made for, if we don't know what Allah had in mind for us, we don't know that. So what purpose do we serve, for ourselves?
Exactly.
We don't know that, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So how would you describe that? What purpose do we have for ourselves?
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
We were talking about purpose.
Yeah.
What is our purpose of life? Apart from what Allah...
What is Amina's purpose of life?
Yeah, apart
living?
From what Allah has made me for, what is my purpose?
Mm-hmm. What is it?
I don't know. Asma, do you know what my purpose is?
Well, I think the purpose of all of us in this life is to accomplish something. That something might be a book. That something might be a gallery of paintings.
No, it doesn't have to be anything grand.
Yeah, I would just tell you.
For me,
that will be only your heart.
You know, I feel like everyone has a time in their life where they have to accomplish something.
Yeah.
And for me personally for me, I'm not speaking for anyone else, as a mother, I want to accomplish being a great mother to my child.
And that's fantastic.
And someone else can be here and they want to be like, I want to be a great daughter to my father.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make that your purpose for now.
Yeah.
And making that your purpose, you have to complete that purpose with Allah in mind.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And that should be, I guess everyone has to find their own purpose in life, slowly.
You know, it depends on how you define your existence, your life, generally life, creation, why you've been sent into this world. As for me, I think that in the end of the day, when this journey of living ends one day, and then here comes the hereafter, the only thing that God is going to judge me accordingly, the only thing that according to it God is going to judge me would be my heart. How
and what
pure
you've done.
My heart.
Of course, but it's the stuff that you did that.
What?
See, so you're just saying that Allah judges you based on your heart, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, with the heart goes the actions. Your heart can be pure, but your actions can be wrong.
No. See, there must be an agreement between what you have done and what you have fostered in your heart.
Of course, you can't just...
I mean, for example, if your heart is pure enough to have the intention of helping other people and you have done it as much as your capacity would let you, as much as your energy would let you to do, then that's a great deal of job. If you have, I don't know, even helping animals would count in God's eyes. Like, to be so kind toward every single creature in this world is so respectful in God's eyes, according to what the narrations tells us. Of course, I'm not saying these things out of myself, out of nowhere, out of the blue. I'm just saying that if I have all of these good intentions in my heart, if I try to shape a heart that is created out of diamond, then I think he would respect that. He would judge it based on my actions, of course.
I'm sorry for interrupting you. I just had to be more clear with it.
Yeah.
You know, what were you saying exactly?
So when I say heart,
you're saying actions
I literally
as well.
Mean heart, but what I mean actually is my actions and how I treated other people. Because we have it in one of the quotes by Imam Ali, mm-hmm. alayhi salam, that says, "You have always been the best God I could have ever imagined. So help me be."
He's saying this to Allah?
Yeah. "Help me be the best obedient you have ever wanted me to be."
If you're listening to this and you're wondering, who am I and what was I created for? Just remember, you were created for Allah, by Allah, for Allah. And at the end of the day, it's always about Allah.
And of course, what adds to your worth is the much of connection you have with Him. And according to that, the way you act with other people.
Yeah.
So this was all.
Unfortunately.
Again, time is running so
fast. We would
love
to keep talking about this.
And it was so interesting, of course.
It was. I kind of learned some new things.
Yeah. And that's a very interesting question. The mere thought of who am I and
it
what
raises,
do I want?
It's so deep.
Yeah.
You just keep going.
And
it's
so
like
interesting.
Very interesting.
One session is not enough, but then that's it. This is the ending point for today's
episode.
So happy to meet you, Amina, and thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us until another session. Bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio, for those who seek the truth.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to Islamic Upbringing on IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab, your host, and I'm thrilled to be here. In this program, we'll be diving into the world of Islamic upbringing, exploring the challenges and triumphs of raising children in harmony with the principles of Islam. From answering your questions to discussing most important topics in parenting, our discussions will be grounded in the wisdom of Quran, Hadith, and the teachings of noble Imams. Today, we are joined by Brother Miqdad, who's a research scholar in the House Al-Miyakum. Let's welcome him. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah to you and to all the brothers and sisters who are listening.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for coming, and we are excited to be here with you today again to benefit from your valuable insights. Well, we said that friendship, when it comes to youngsters, takes a new stage. It has a new meaning now. And teenagers consider this friendship as a social need. They're emotionally attached to their friends, and This is not just a simple emotional attachment, it's a strong emotional attachment wherein they are very comfortable to speak about even their private matters to their friends. But Brother Meghdad told us in the previous episode that this needs to be managed properly. So, Brother Meghdad, what can we do to direct them?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, it's a very good point. We talked about how important it is to direct these energies of children, and one of them being this strong attachment, emotional attachment that teenagers build with their friends, same gender. And this attachment can be an opportunity for parents. It can be an opportunity for not just parents, but for teachers, for community as a whole, to help a child in their upbringing and in their growth. This is a general point. As I mentioned, we should look at these as opportunities. What can we do with it? Sometimes we have a very negative view towards teenagers. We feel that teenagers have all these negative traits and we have to deal with them.
Because
we lack
the actual traits or skills to
exactly,
help
because
them
we don't
out,
know
yeah.
what to do and,
right.
and we don't see it in a positive light. Whilst actually even this friendship, for example, it's actually an opportunity. We can do many things. Let me give a few examples of what can be done. One of the things, for example, is to use friendship as a way of learning. You see, a teenager, because of different traits that they have, they're very difficult to convince, for example, or to teach a teenager might be a bit difficult as an adult.
Right.
But now, if we were to use friends as an opportunity to teach, so imagine a teenager learns something from a friend that they really believe in, a friend that they're really attached to, a friend that they accept as somebody who they would trust. The learning that they would have from that experience would be nothing, will be amazing compared to a learning that would happen from a teacher. Imagine a parent comes to a child and tells a teenager on the importance of salah, right?
Yes.
Teenager will listen to it, might not listen to it. It won't have that much effect. But imagine if it's a friend that the teenager really loves and respects and has trust, and that friend tells them about the importance of prayer. I think this teenager will pray with a lot of love, will pray with a lot of attention. So you find that teenagers, when they learn together, right,
mm-hmm.
Their learning experience increases. And
yes.
So as parents, rather than seeing friendship as a negative thing, we can use friendship as an opportunity to teach children.
Right.
So using that bridge to get a child to learn certain things. And this is why, for example, when teenagers get together in library, for example, they usually study better than if they were alone or if they had a teacher, for example. And so somehow we need to gap this learning through friends, through people that they have a lot of respect for, which is usually people of their own peers and their own age group and their own gender.
You
and
remind
so this
me
is one
of
example.
My college and university days when we had a huge, huge syllabus, and then we would divide among the friends and we would say, you study the unit first and I'll study the unit second and others will study unit 3 and 4, and then we'll explain for each other, because we really would split our time and studies like that, and we would learn that in a much better way while we were splitting those. So, well, we'll discuss more after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic upbringing. I'm with Brother Mekhtad, and we're helping parents to navigate the ship of teenagers, which can be damaged by the strong, rough waves. Well, Brother Mekhtad said that use friendship as a way of learning. Teenagers love to learn together from their friends, so learning experience also increases. Parents should use this as opportunity. They should look at this stage as an opportunity rather than getting furious about the changes of the stage.
This acceptability is very important. You see, teenagers, they value something when it comes from somebody that they accept. Unfortunately, because of lack of experience or lack of skills and technique methods, parents and teenagers don't usually have a good relationship. And at times, unfortunately, teenagers lose that acceptability from parents, right? So they don't really accept what comes from their parents. Now, there's different factors that why this happens, maybe for another discussion and how to avoid it. But this is the case, right? That children, when they hear from parents, and sometimes even for adults, right? They lose that acceptability from seniors, from people who are older than them, from parents and teachers. And so therefore, learning reduces, and they will be unlikely to listen. And that's why they will come around and say, you have to prove it to me or I won't accept. If I don't understand, I won't take it from you. I don't trust you.
Right.
But when it comes to their friends, right?
They accept easily.
They accept straight away. They will never ask their friend, oh, you have to prove it to me. They'll just take it straight, right? My friend said this. Because they have this acceptability, that I accept my friend. I trust my friend, right?
Yes.
And so as parents and teachers, we need to use that opportunity. We shouldn't see this as necessarily a negative thing, but rather use it.
Yes.
If you're able to convince the friend, for example, and through different methods.
There you go.
Exactly. Prepare a ground for learning to happen between them,
right,
where they learn from each other, they teach each other. Then the acceptability is there, and therefore learning will happen in a better way. And so this is a way to increase the learning and to use this opportunity of friendship. Another example is spirituality. Right?
Yes.
When we look at, when we look at spirituality and children and teenagers, don't really want to pray and fast and read the Quran, find these things a bit boring, a bit things to do that are not fun and entertaining.
Yes.
But for example, if you were to bring them all together as their friends and say, let's have a Quran circle, for example, and we all together as friends sit down and read the Quran, you would find that this will be accepted, that this will be much easier.
It would give much better results.
Exactly. If you organize, for example, an i'tikaf in the month of Ramadan, you have this program, these 3 days that we spend at the mosque, at the masjid called i'tikaf, you find how many youths attend the i'tikaf, how many teenagers attend i'tikaf. Why do they attend i'tikaf? Why are they ready to fast for 3 days, sacrifice their food and their comfort of their bed and come to the mosque and ready to sit down for a dua, for a long dua? Why? Because they're there together with their friends.
Yes.
So using this friendship, using this social thirst that they have, this they want to spend time with their friends.
Can use it to bridge.
For an opportunity to create a spiritual gathering, to create a spiritual environment, to create opportunity for them to worship Allah.
Right.
And so this is an opportunity. We've used friendship, we use the thirst for their friends that they have in a way that promotes spirituality, promotes worship,
right,
promotes them to come back to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes, we'll get back to you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Ya
Welcome back. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about friendship in youth, and we said they have this great acceptability from their friends, and parents can use this stage as an opportunity rather than looking at it negatively. So they can use their friends as a way of learning, and because they learn from each other in a better way. And they can also learn from their spiritual experiences. Brother said that when it comes to spirituality, they again learn together, pay more attention, and accept things together.
Another positive way of looking at this friendship and
stage of teenagers
and using it as an opportunity is, for example, to teach children certain important traits. Teach teenagers certain important traits. You see, teenagers, it's a stage of life that requires some important skills. And obviously, ideally, this happens before they reach teenagehood. Something that parents should have inculcated in them from before. But it's possible to gain these skills even during puberty, right, even during teenagehood. And using friendship for this is very important. So I'll give you a couple of examples. One of them is the ability to think, right? Teenagers need to build the faculty of thinking, of planning, of being able to analyze situation and look ahead of the game. One of the things that we find in teenagers is that they don't necessarily have a very strong willpower. And that leads to mistakes that they commit, whether it's related to conduct with the opposite gender or falling into sins like music, like smoking, like drugs, God forbid. All of these things happen usually because they don't have a strong willpower.
Right.
One of the ways to create willpower is to have the skill of analyzing, the ability to analyze, to think about consequence.
Right.
If a teenager is able to think about consequence and follow their action based on the consequences that they are able to think about and analyze, this really creates a strong willpower. And so we need to build the skill in children to be able to, as I say in Arabic, to be mutafakir, to have this power of ta'aqul, to be able to think, ponder, reflect, analyze, predict, think long term. And based on that, they're able to then lead their lives in a more healthy way.
Right. And in addition to these teenagers, parents need to have those essential skills to help them navigate. Well, we will be helping you, their parents and teenagers, with more skills in the upcoming episodes. Until then, take good care of yourself. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The Zionist lobby plays down the amount it spends on influencing policy in the United States. So in today's show, we'll be laying bare the reality. To set the scene, Latifa Abu Chakra has this report about the way in which the Zionist lobby's expenditure is reported.
APAC, or to give it its full name, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, is perhaps the best known Israel lobby group in the world. But how important is it really? Some say that its influence has been exaggerated and that, in the end, the most it can do is influence policies at the margins. Certainly, the Zionist movement is keen to downplay its influence. Here is a report in the tablet. How influential is APAC? Less than beer sellers, public accountants, and Toyota. Among the points made are that the way APAC is talked about, you'd think they'd be a lobbying juggernaut, surely one of the largest in the nation's capital. Wrong. Between 1998 and 2018, APAC didn't make a dent in the Center for Responsive Politics' list of the top spending lobbying groups. In 2018, total pro-Israel lobbying spending was around $5 million, of which AIPAC accounted for $3.5 million. In contrast, Native American casinos spent around $22 million that year. By tablets count, AIPAC was the 147th highest ranked entity in terms of lobbying spending in 2018. This is an attempt to pretend that the influence of the Zionist movement is much less than suggested by critics. Against that, we can set the following. Taking the figure disclosed to the lobbying regulator as if that was all AIPAC spends on lobbying is profoundly mistaken. Though it disclosed only $2.7 million lobby expenditure in 2022, its actual expenditure was $79.1 million. In addition, AIPAC controls another nonprofit, which it uses to pursue Zionist interests, which discloses nothing to the regulator, yet had a 2022 expenditure of a further $44.6 million. Looking more widely at the Israel lobby in general, in fact, declared lobbying expenditure by the lobby in 2018 was $7 million, not around $5 million, as stated by the tablet. The figure for 2022 was $5.4 million. But even that is woefully inadequate, as it does not include, for example, the $6.3 million spent in 2022 by Israeli firms, including arms firms, Elbit, Rafael, Israel Aerospace Industries, and phone hacking firm, Celebrite. $16 million in the same year spent by registered foreign agents of Israel, including the government, the World Zionist Organization, the Jewish Agency, and the phone hacking firm, NSO Group. But even that pales into insignificance when compared with the data compiled by the IsraelLobby.org website. Data compiled there on Zionist groups providing subsidy to the Zionist entity, including to illegal settlements and the occupation forces, and lobbying and education, shows a total budget of $3.6 billion as long ago as 2012, rising to an estimate $6.3 billion in 2020. It's time to get real about the spending power of the lobby.
Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert and eminent scholarly critic of Israel, David Miller. David's a senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University, and he's a co-director of a lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. Today's guest contributor is an American human rights lawyer, Dan Kovalik. Dan taught international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh until last year, and he's written extensively too. His books have focused on human rights and US foreign policy, and his latest book, The Case for Palestine, Why It Matters and Why You Should Care, was published in May this year and includes a foreword by George Galloway. Welcome to the show. David, what's behind the rationale then, do you think, with the Zionists trying to minimise the influence of AIPAC?
Well, the Zionists try and pretend that they don't really exist. I mean, when you say that an organisation is a Zionist organisation, they quite often say, oh, no, it's just an ordinary Jewish communal organisation. And you point out that in their constitution they say they support Israel or that they're affiliated to the World Zionist Organization. They don't want to have any open conversation about what the Zionist movement is, about the existence of it, about the existence of the Israel lobby or the Zionist lobby. And so they try and pretend that it's not really a very significant thing. Yes, of course, they need lobby for Israel, but it's just like any other lobby. There's nothing to see here. Don't even bother yourself about this. So it's an attempt to try and divert attention away from the actual facts about how the Zionist movement, the Israel lobby, operates.
Mm. Well, Dan, you've confronted AIPAC-supported politicians about their unwillingness to back a ceasefire, like the Democrat Senator John Fetterman. I mean, tell our viewers what actually happened.
Yeah, so I kindly, nicely went up to Senator Fetterman, who's a Democrat, who I actually supported at one time, and I said that he should consider supporting a ceasefire because of all the deaths that have been caused by Israel and Gaza, and half of them children. And before talking for very long, he had me thrown out of the venue that I had a ticket for, by the way, physically removed. And he never even bothered to try to answer my question or explain his position. And, you know, since that time, that was pretty early on. I think that was in maybe even October of 2023 or early November. He's become even more kind of entrenched in his support for Israel, even willing to really do